If I told you that on election day, Amash won one state, which state would it be?
What's the weirdest state?
Michigan, because he's from Michigan.
Not Utah? I thought it might be Utah.
Yeah, you had to go like the quirkiest state.
Oh, Utah. Yeah, if Evan McMullen wound up getting like
20 something.
Pretty high, right?
Yeah.
17 or 20, you know. Maybe Utah would be in play.
Hello and welcome to the 538 Politics Podcast. I'm Galen Daruk. On Friday, former Vice President Joe Biden personally denied allegations of sexual assault from his former Senate staffer, Tara Reid. His campaign had previously denied the allegations through a spokesperson. So how are high-profile elected Democrats and voters reacting to the allegations and Biden's response? Also, another competitor is likely joining the race between Biden and President Trump. Michigan Congressman Justin Amash announced his exploratory committee for president last week. He's a former Republican and member of the Freedom Caucus. He was an independent until Friday when he officially became a libertarian. So why is he planning a run and how could it affect the race? We're going to get into all of that today. Here with me to do that, our editor-in-chief, Nate Silver. Hey, Nate.
Hey, Galen.
Also here with us, senior politics writer Claire Malone. Hey, Claire.
Hi, Galen.
And managing editor Micah Cohen. Hey, Micah.
Hello, Galen. Hello, everyone.
I also want to mention before we get started that 538 is launching a new podcast focused on the coronavirus pandemic. It's called Podcast 19. There's still a lot unknown about the virus, and our colleague Anna Rothschild and our former politics podcast intern Jake Arlo are going to be tracking what the scientific community is learning in real time, as well as some of the economic and political fallout from the pandemic. They'll also be answering a lot of your questions, so I encourage everyone to go check it out wherever you get your podcasts and stick around a little later for a preview. So on that note, and before we get to Biden and Amash, let's check in on where we are in the coronavirus crisis, as we've been doing. So as of Monday morning, the reported deaths from COVID-19 in the U.S. are nearing 70,000. And we launched a tracker that aggregates several different forecasts of the death toll from COVID-19. Nate, looking at that and looking at those projections, what do we know right now about where we are broadly in the course of this pandemic in the United States and where we're headed?
I don't think we know that much about where we are or where we're headed. So deaths are at some type of plateau. It may be a plateau with a gentle slope downward. Clearly, in some of the most hardest hit regions, so in New York, New Jersey, Connecticut, the numbers have fallen quite a lot. In New Orleans, numbers have fallen quite a lot. In Michigan, they've gotten better. The problem is if you kind of subtract out those regions that were hit relatively early and are now on the downside of a slope, then it's not clear that the country is making that much progress. The numbers look pretty flat. Depends on which metrics you look at. There are also things like we're going back now and capturing deaths that occurred maybe weeks ago that we never counted before, like in nursing homes, for example. You can look at how many cases there are, but cases, as we emphasize, are subject to testing. There have been more tests conducted in the U.S., and that's good. So if you get more tests, you'll find more cases. That may or may not be a real increase, potentially. But we're not seeing, I'll put it like this, we're not seeing the big bell curve type decline that some of the people or models or assumptions might have hoped for, right? We are almost seeing that in a few places like New York, which is what partly makes things confusing, but we're certainly not seeing that nationwide.
Is there a sense for why deaths have plateaued at this point?
Well, partly because, you know, our social distancing has not been that stringent, right? Number one. And number two, that's kind of the only tool we've been using, right? We haven't really been doing that much testing, although it's gotten a little bit better. Most states have been doing contact tracing. You know, mask wearing is good in some places, but not others. You know, social distancing was not supposed to be the only tool we had, in part because it's costly, and in part because kind of the American version of it, where there is still this whole big carve out for whatever, a third of the workforce, essential services, then those are people who are not able to kind of stop the spread and are not reaping the benefits of social distancing like the rest of us can, at least staying healthier potentially. And so, yeah, I mean, look, one answer is that American-style social distancing is enough to kind of flatten the curve in the original sense, but maybe not bend it downward that much. And in places like New York, you might see a steeper decline because, number one, people are a little bit more strict about distancing when they're in areas that have been harder hit. But number two, frankly, in New York, enough people have got it at some point. The state says 20% of people in New York City have antibodies for coronavirus. If 20% of people have antibodies, that can actually have some effect with partial herd immunity. We don't want the rest of the country to have 20% of people get it, right? If you do happen to make it to that point where 20 or might be higher, 25% or something have it, then the numbers seem to come down a little bit more. The other thing that I think is worth keeping in mind is that there was a lot of data this week on mobility. So Apple and other companies track literally how much people are moving around, driving, walking, public transit. People were moving around a lot more this weekend than they had in the past. It's especially true in states where you have big shifts in weather. People are excited to get outside. It's a little bit more true actually in red states than in blue states. A little bit more true in places where there are fewer cases and deaths. But it's happening everywhere, and all the kind of anecdotal accounts about, hey, I see more people in the park and I see more people driving around, right? That's validated by the data. And so I think we're going to have begin to have a more fierce debate about reopening, where it's not just some protesters in a state capital somewhere, but it's people kind of losing tolerance for social distancing at a time when it's not clear how much better the situation is getting.
I will say, I'm in New York. I think Galen and Claire are in New York too, New York City. Nate, you're not in New York, right?
I am in Westchester County.
Right. We had like the first really nice weekend, I think, of the spring probably. Both days, Saturday, Sunday, were really nice. And not only were more people out, but I live in Harlem, and I had noticed a real uptick in the number of people wearing masks. Almost everybody I saw for the past 6 weeks had been wearing masks after I think it took a little bit for those masks to be adopted. I've really noticed a stark decline in the number of people wearing masks. So just, I'd say that just to kind of back up what Nate was saying. And the other thing is, and I'm like reacting to this in real time, that the New York Times just published this. Apparently they got a hold of an internal CDC report that has the number of positive cases and the number of deaths kind of increasing over like the daily death count increasing to about 3,000 by early June. Now, I say that not to say that like that projection is gospel, but just to say that it does feel like we're in kind of a really important moment as states begin to open back up where things could get worse pretty quickly based on some projections if, you know, the wrong conditions are in place.
And what's our, Italy, I feel like has, particularly for city dwellers, for New Yorkers, has sort of been a marker. What are the numbers like there for sort of like the reopening? Has there been a backslide as far as, you know, I guess an uptick in cases?
Well, Italy has partly reopened this. The train station was opened in Milan today. So look, here's the thing. In Italy, you have the same thing happening as in New York, where so many people got it that does slow it down a bit. People don't want to, I mean, there's so much, I don't know how to put this. People are so afraid to talk about like any effects from herd immunity because they think people will say, okay, well, let's just kind of rip the cord off and go for herd immunity, right? And a lot of epidemiologists would not think it's a good idea, right? However, it is the case that, you know, in Bergamo, Italy, there have been serological surveys showing that 60% or something of that city, which may be the worst affected place in the world, had it. If you have 60% already had it, then you're going to have maybe actually true herd immunity in that particular locale. And so that does have an effect. And when you see numbers coming down at a fairly steep rate in Italy or New York or Spain, maybe parts of France even, that's because like so many people had it that like it becomes a bit harder to spread. That's not true for the U.S. as a whole. So in some ways, we focus on the worst affected areas. But the worst affected areas are going to have a steeper decline for lots of reasons than the average area. So yeah, I mean, if the whole country went through what New York or Italy experienced, then on the backside of that, you might have steeper declines. I don't think the whole country wants to experience that.
Well, and that's the thing is, just because we do tend to focus on the political consequences here, if these newly reported CDC projections come to fruition and there is an increase in the daily death toll in the daily case count, then I think we're talking about like a whole nother level of political repercussions in terms of Trump than we are now. I mean, that would be fairly devastating in actual terms, but also in political terms, I think.
Yeah. Obviously, states are beginning to open up now. It's something like half of the states in the country or a little bit more are in some phase of reopening. And as we've mentioned, it really takes 2 to 3 weeks to see what happens to the spread as restrictions are lifted. So we'll definitely talk a lot more on this podcast about the repercussions of those moves as we see them. But we do have a lot to talk about today. So I want to get on to our next topic. But first, today's podcast is brought to you by Audible. Audible is the leading provider of spoken word entertainment and audiobooks, ranging from bestsellers to celebrity memoirs, news, business. Every month, members get one credit to pick any title, plus 2 Audible originals from a monthly selection. And they also get access to daily news digests from the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, and the Washington Post, as well as guided meditation programs, which could be particularly useful these days. They've got plenty of content that can help you pursue your goals, whether it's getting fit, finishing more books, or becoming a better parent or leader. I'm personally enjoying an oldie but goodie of Human Bondage by Somerset Maugham, but really, they have anything you could be looking for. It. They've got thousands of titles. Fun fact, if you listen to every title on Audible, you'd be listening for more than 3 centuries, unless you dial up your narration speed, of course. To get set up now, go to audible.com/538. That's audible.com/538. Or you can text 538 to 500-500. Again, that's 538 to 500-500. We're back, and as I mentioned at the top, Biden denied a sexual assault accusation from his former Senate staffer, Tara Reid, publicly on Friday. Her account is that he pinned her against a wall and reached up her skirt in a building in the Capitol area in 1993. The Washington Post and the New York Times published investigative reports looking into this. They spoke with a friend who anonymously corroborated Reid's story and numerous former staffers who did not recall the story or any other assault allegation taking place. Business Insider spoke with Reid's neighbor from the mid-90s who corroborated Reid's account, and various outlets have found inconsistencies in Reid's accounting. So I just kind of want to ask this broadly now that Biden has taken the step to publicly talk about it and deny it. Does that denial suffice for Democrats to move forward with nominating and supporting Joe Biden?
I mean, I wrote about this a little on Friday. Not a little, I guess I wrote a piece. And this is, I think, setting aside, there is a real and valid conversation about the veracity of the claims, how you prove the veracity of sexual assault claims, all that stuff. Let's table that for a second. And I think we're confining this, at least for right now, to sort of the political ramifications of this, which, you know, might sound crass to you, but also politics is kind of crass. And, you know, kind of what I tried to tackle was basically the real politique concerns of Democrats, right? Which is, this is a party that has embraced the Me Too ethos, the believe women ethos of Me Too, in no small part because, especially, you know, in the past 4 years, there's been a huge movement of women to the Democratic Party. And it's consistently, you know, women's interest groups have been a real strong and important part of Democratic, you know, coalitions. Biden was getting critique from a lot of groups within the party or interest groups within the party for having been too silent on this. Maybe that's because Tara Reid's claims were seen by them at first as being, let's just not give oxygen to this. There, you know, there's too many weird things going on with this story. But I think you've ultimately seen in the past week a situation that is probably from a political point of view pretty good for Joe Biden, which is a lot of women elected officials in the party have come out and vocally said, yes, I believe women, but also I believe Joe Biden here. And that has been a really important thing for Biden. And I think it probably, frankly, helps him. This is sort of a weird way to put it. But the fact that the president has, I believe, 17 allegations of sexual assault against him, including rape, that makes people kind of have this, well, which is worse? Let's assuming everything is true for both of these guys. Which would be worse to have in office? Okay, Biden is maybe the lesser of two evils, so I'll go out and support him. So it's kind of a weird odd, dark political storyline here, that we are going to go into the 2020 election with two sexual assault stories swirling around the nominees.
Yeah, it's been super interesting to watch this dynamic Claire wrote about and just talked about, where, and I don't, if I describe this incorrectly, people jump in, but it feels like, at least among Democratic Party elites, including elected officials and interest groups, the line has gone from believe women to every woman deserves to be heard and all allegations should be investigated thoroughly, which are two different things. And substance aside, I mean, maybe the latter position is the position you personally actually think we should end up at, right? It's certainly not a coincidence that you've seen this shift to this new position as the Democratic Party nominee is facing these allegations.
It's a totally interesting point, and I think, you know, you saw, I think the Al Franken situation is a pretty good precedent for what Biden is going through and something to look at. You know, Franken was accused of forcibly kissing people and potentially groping people. And you saw a lot of actually ambiguity among Democratic voters about whether or not he should step down at the time. You know, a lot of people in polls back in 2017 when the allegations against him happened, or 2018, it kind of straddled those years. People were saying, well, let's wait for the results of an ethics investigation. You know, there weren't as many people, Democrats, outright saying Franken should resign. But there was then this movement by his Senate colleagues to say, nope, he needs to step down, obviously sort of famously led by Kirsten Gillibrand. And then I think that had sort of some redounding effects on her career, potentially when she ran for president. But there was a more, you know, tepid feeling by Democratic voters, you know, as far as absolutism goes within the Believe Women, Me Too movement when it came to someone who was, frankly, a star within the Democratic Party. And I think what you're running into here for Democrats specifically are the movement to believe women is, I think, a really effective line that activists and advocates for women took in order to, I'd say, change the culture and conversation around the way we discuss sexual assault, right? Which had sort of overwhelmingly tipped to men. I think the legal considerations are sort of very different, right? Like in a court of law, it's still, you know, innocent until proven guilty, right? The court of public opinion, though, is very different. And so what we're seeing right now is, setting aside sort of the court of law and whether or not, you know, sexual assault cases are very difficult to prove and to try, and they're obviously really messy and all that stuff. But in the court of public opinion, what the Democrats are doing right now is sort of trying to make, I would say, a slight shift towards the center to bring in more of those, like, legalistic, well, these things are messy situations, and there's a lot of gray area. And I think that's been really interesting, is to watch how the court of public opinion is being managed by the Democrats.
Yeah, it's worth saying here that we're not going to be able to determine during the course of this segment whether or not these claims are true, and we may or may not have some kind of definitive conclusion between now and election day. But we are, as you said, Claire, talking about the politics. And so when it does come to the voter side of this, you said in the Al Franken case, they were more skeptical of the idea that he should just step down before any kind of ethics investigation, whereas the party elites were more forceful in pushing him out. We've seen this time around, party elites are still backing Biden, still supporting him. Where are the voters this time around?
Yeah, I mean, it's early to say, Gaylen, right? Because I think the mainstream news media was slow to cover this. And I would expect to see and we've already seen a jump in coverage now that Biden has actually commented personally on it. But YouGov had a poll, for example, where, you know, they asked, how much have you heard about this story? And only 16% of people had heard a lot. About half of people, 49%, had heard a little, and about a third of people had heard nothing at all. So I would say we're in the very early going here. But that YouGov poll also asked people, do you find the allegation against Joe Biden credible or not credible? Overall, about one in four people, 26%, said credible. 15% said not credible, and almost half, 45%, said they haven't heard enough. If you lump in not sure with that, then you're up to 60%. A majority of people basically don't know yet, right? If you look at the partisan crosstabs, party ID, Democrats were the least likely to say the allegations were credible. 17% versus 22% for independents and 43% for Republicans. Again, though, most people are in the kind of like, I don't know enough about this yet. But if you had any illusions that like voters would not view this stuff through a partisan lens, then you were kidding yourself, right? I think everyone views everything through a partisan lens. And in a lot of ways, how elected officials reacted to Franken was the outlier in that you had members of his own party pushing for his ouster. All this other stuff is very much the norm.
And I do want to just add to what you said, Micah, if we get to the point where a lot more people hear about it and this is verified one way or another, they also ask, you know, if these allegations are true, that YouGov poll, do you think this disqualifies him from the presidency? And the overall number was 29% said they thought it disqualified him. And that is 23% Democrats, 33% Republicans. So even if people believed this were true, heard a lot about it in the press or in political advertising, the degree to which people feel like it would disqualify Biden from the presidency is still somewhat limited.
I mean, this is the whole thing is like, I think it's one reason why the media, I think we talked about this before, but it's one reason why the media was slow to cover this is the allegations against Trump, and there are many of them, and then there's also video of him bragging about sexual assault, cast a pall over any story about Biden, right? Because so much of the media coverage, even implied, starts with a horse race premise. How will this affect the election? The likely answer is it probably won't have a big effect on the election either way, really. And my bet would be that that would be true even if some definitive proof came out. Maybe. That would be my bet at least. I wouldn't be shocked if it did. But like, so if that's the case, then I think for a lot of the media, you know, they're not sure which angle to cover it from, because the other obvious angle is this true or not? And as Claire was saying at the start, these kind of cases, you're almost never going to get, you know, a definitive answer one way or the other.
It's also, I mean, it's the whataboutism that has crept into American political life, right? I mean, Trump, I guess, cannily did the whatabout move in 2016 when he was, you know, accused of all of these sexual assaults. And then he said, well, Hillary Clinton turned a blind eye to her husband's sexual abuse. How terrible, right? So he turned it on her. And I think we're seeing, you know, I said before, we're going to see a 2020 election that centers around, that has storylines of sexual assault around both candidates. Well, you know what? We had that in 2016 to a certain degree. So it is this kind of, I mean, maybe he did this thing, but this person did this other thing. So what about that? And I think it's kind of just a pervasive phenomenon in our political culture right now.
So we've talked about where we are in this political moment, but there's about almost exactly 6 months between today and Election Day. So how does this end up playing out going forward, both in how the press covers this, how this is vetted? You know, there's a lot of time for this story to potentially evolve. So where do we see things heading from here?
I mean, look, I think that if there are no big revelations on the other side, so what would big revelations be, right? Big revelation might be that there is some type of contemporaneous documentation. A big revelation might be that there are other credible accusers. Those might be the kind of two big categories, right? On the flip side, if there's a revelation that would really cut at her credibility above and beyond the ordinary ways that partisans always attack people's credibility, or if she rescinds it, or, you know, whatever. If none of those kind of outlier outcomes happen, I guess they're outliers, but like, then I think it probably would fade somewhat in the public's memory by Election Day. I mean, you actually already have Democrats saying Trump is so bad that, like, even if he did do this, then I would still have to vote for Biden. And it might be easier to do that when the other party, Trump, has been accused of multiple incidents of sexual assault and adjacent things to that. And so I don't know, right? I don't think the question about like how the press should have been covering it is hugely straightforward. And it's a difficult case, right? And I think they probably are doing a lot of reporting on background that affects the decisions that they make potentially. It can also be affected by politics potentially. But, you know.
So to clarify, you're talking here about like the accusation largely from the right, but also there's just been some ongoing media criticism about the mainstream press not giving enough airtime to these accusations. And the implication has been in large part that it's based on partisan motivations because of the belief that the mainstream press has a left-leaning bias. And so, I mean, do you find that criticism of the way the press has handled this to be legitimate?
I think it probably is. I mean, look, I'm not someone who goes around saying that the media doesn't have any biases, right? I think the fact that the average newsroom employee is at least culturally liberal, probably not a big fan of Trump. I mean, I think that can affect lots of decisions in different ways. I do think on something like this, though, you know, the media reported the Al Franken accusations and like reported lots of kind of stuff about Bill Clinton, although that's kind of a long time ago. Maybe Bill Clinton is something where people were more circumspect in how they talked about it potentially. But I'm also saying that like this is not an open and shut case, right? On the spectrum between, hey, this seems rock solid, even if you can't prove it, to hey, this seems totally out of left field and totally obviously fabricated, you know, it's neither of those, right? It's somewhere in the big mushy middle between being very credible and being not very credible. And there's a whole big in-between space there, right? And
sexual assault reporting is very complicated. I mean, I think that's also what this comes down to. I understand people's reactions saying like, oh, the left-wing media wasn't reporting this. What's wrong with them? You know, the left-leaning media wasn't reporting this. And those criticisms coming from the far left of the Democratic Party or the right. But when it comes down to it, reporting sexual assault allegations is a weighty and complicated thing. I think you read the stories from the major newspapers about her story, and you do see some of the seams of the reporting and some of the conversations that are probably happening editorially about inconsistencies or whatever. You know, and I do want to say here what is, I think, troubling to activists or sexual assault advocates or, you know, victims of rape or sexual assault is that often Americans interact with this dialogue via politics, right? Via a partisan lens on something. So we obviously saw the Kavanaugh hearings, right? And we saw a huge gender split in polling between the way men and women viewed it, between the way Republicans and Democrats viewed it. And Christine Blasey Ford was a quote unquote ideal victim, right? Someone who appeared to be very earnest, appeared to, you know, maybe not be in it for any personal gain, appeared, you know, credible, all this stuff, right? There was a lot of talk about that. What a great witness. Tara Reid, I think, has a more complicated background. And I think we also have to talk about that, which is that the public does make these implicit judgments about people and whether or not they're credible. And then you layer on the idea of politics and you've got this super soupy story that I do think is very different from the majority of sexual assault cases in the country, which are not politicized. They're ordinary is a terrible word for it, but that's what it is. It's an ordinary phenomenon in America, sexual violence. So that's what I think it also makes it so difficult. And journalistically, we have to take assault allegations carefully and parse through them.
Yeah, and there is a lot of political context to this as well in terms of women's beliefs. And so, you know, it's a complicated case. I'll put it that way, right? You know, I do think the point that seems inevitable and kind of valid to me, right, is it does make it clear that, like, kind of liberals' notion of, okay, well, always believe the woman, right? Believe women. I mean, that gets complicated clearly by something like this. I mean, that is a point where you can accuse the left of, I think, appropriately, of like hypocrisy.
And so do they just have to modify that position going forward? Like, does this act as some kind of turning point in how the left presents the Me Too movement and talks about it in public?
But I mean, look, if you have the Democratic nominee for president accused of this behavior, accused of sexual assault, right? And you have a lot of prominent liberals saying, well, I'm going to vote for him anyway, or I don't believe her, or hey, she's not credible, then that seems like it would be potentially a turning point, right? You know, whether it's a turning point to a to what place, I don't know, but like that seems like it would be, it seems like we'd have to have like a more, I don't know, a more complicated and nuanced discussion about how Me Too proceeds with stuff like this, right? But yeah, I mean, you know, I think there's also like the flip side where there are people in the Me Too movement who are like, I'm really mad about this accusation because it is a messy accusation, right? With all types of political backstory tied up in it. And that kind of makes it a lot harder to deal with too. And so I don't know. I mean, but yeah, I mean, it's in some ways the future of the Me Too movement, I think, is at more risk in some ways than Joe Biden's candidacy.
Well, I think Galen was smart to drop in some stuff in our, you know, in our preparation channel that talked about the way women's groups were responding to this and sort of the report that the Time's Up group had sort of declined to help Tara Reid in her case. So there is an indication from within that movement itself that there is trepidation about getting involved with something like this, because obviously there's discussion among people in those groups about, well, could this be risky? Could it risk our credibility with, you know, the broader movement? Would it get it mired in, you know, too deep in the messy world of politics? So it is, messy.
Let me just throw in a few things. One is, if there is what is your default position when an allegation surfaces? And that default position for the Me Too movement or Democratic elected officials shifts from believe women to everyone should get a chance to be heard and all claims should be seriously investigated. What's important to realize is like that if that shift happens, it will be a shift having to do with allegations surfacing in the context of politics. And the reason that's important is there are reasons why allegations might surface in politics that don't exist in everyday life. False allegations in everyday life are exceedingly rare, to the point where it's like, it's not really even worth talking about, really. In the context of politics, that's a little different. And so it's somewhat unique circumstances. The other thing is saying, I'm still going to vote for Biden isn't inherently a contradiction of the believe women message. I was listening to the Political Gabfest and Emily Bazelon was saying like, well, wait a second, you know, as a feminist and as a woman, I get to be kind of real politique too, right? Like just because I'm a feminist doesn't mean I don't get to like make hard-edged political decisions. And if that decision is, oh yeah, I'm going to vote for the guy with kind of one complicated allegation over the guy with 2,000 allegations, that's not a refutation, right, of a believe women message. Certainly, though, going back to the start of this, though, I do think like there are a lot of people on the left right now saying things that people on the right were saying during the Kavanaugh hearings, and and those people on the right were getting shouted down, and now people on the left, many of whom were doing the shouting down, are saying the same things. That doesn't mean that the people on the right during Kavanaugh were operating in good faith. I think most of them weren't, right? And it doesn't mean people are operating in good faith now. I think mostly nobody operates in good faith.
On that extremely pessimistic note, any final thoughts as we're wrapping up here?
I think the honest consideration that most Democratic voters will make probably in the privacy of their own home or with the people that they're closest to when they're talking about this is their consideration will be, let's assume all of it's true. which is worse, Trump or Biden, which is what Micah was basically saying. And I do think the reality of it is a lot of Democrats will probably still vote for Biden because people, you know, and then I think that there's a set of very vocal, active people who are essentially party activists who will be litigating this online for a very long time. But I think a lot of Americans, I mean, polls showed that Americans are super disenchanted by politics and politicians in particular. So a lot of people are kind of like, eh, they're all scummy. Like, I'll just vote for the one I think is less scummy, which again was the dynamic of the 2016 election too, if you looked at, you know, historically disliked candidates.
Right. Trump wins amongst voters who dislike both.
I think right. 2016 also affects the way that the news media handles it and kind of affects the discourse that liberals have with the news media. We also see a lot of, okay, I don't want to go into another story election where things are cast in shadows and doubts and uncertainties for, I mean, they're different, right? With Hillary Clinton and emails, you have something which was kind of proven, but relatively minor. With Biden, you have something that, if true, would be very serious, but is unproven and may be hard to ever prove either way. But still, you know, the notion of like kind of lingering doubts and that kind of phraseology is something that I think Democrats are wary of in the way the media covers it. And so there might be kind of like more assertive pushback against how the media is covering it. Especially saying, okay, now it's going to be 2016 all over again, right? And that's a dynamic too that I think is kind of worth watching.
All right. Well, we will see how this all plays out. But for now, let's move on and talk about Justin Amash's bid for the White House. And before we do that, today's podcast is brought to you by ZipRecruiter. And here's a message from our sponsor, ZipRecruiter. Right now, we cannot be overwhelmed. We have to work to keep our loved ones safe and protect our communities. We have to stay strong, to stay connected, to stay focused. We have to work to inspire, to innovate, to build new solutions. But for all this work, we have to work together. And at ZipRecruiter, they connect employers and people every day. But today is different. They're partnering with first responders, government officials, the medical community, the innovators, and the manufacturing, transportation, and food distribution industries to make sure that everyone is finding the right people for the right jobs right now. So let's work together. Go to ZipRecruiter.com/work together. Again, that's ZipRecruiter.com/work together. Today's podcast is also brought to you by Lightstream. Are you paying more money in interest than you need to on your credit cards? Well, you can refinance your debt today with a credit card consolidation loan from Lightstream. Quickly roll balances from multiple credit cards into one single monthly loan payment, and you can get a rate as low as 5.95% APR with AutoPay, much lower than the national average credit card rate of over 19% APR. Plus, there are absolutely no fees. The application is quick and easy and is 100% online, and you can even get your money as soon as the day you apply. Lightstream believes that people with good credit deserve a better loan experience, and that's exactly what they deliver. Apply today to get a special interest rate discount and save even more. The only way to get this discount is to go to lightstream.com/538. That's lightstream.com/538. The numbers, not the letters. Subject to credit approval, rate includes 0.5% auto pay discount. Terms and conditions apply, and offers are subject to change without notice. Visit lightstream.com/538 for more information. We're back, and Michigan Congressman Justin Amash announced his exploratory committee for president last Tuesday and officially changed his party registration from independent to libertarian on Friday. Now, the Libertarian nominating convention is currently scheduled for Memorial Day weekend. So, you know, TBD whether he'll get that nomination, but it seems like he plans on running. And so that means Amash could be on the ballot in November alongside Biden and Trump. I guess let's begin with the basics here, which is rationale. Claire, why is Justin Amash planning a third party campaign for the presidency?
Because it's fun. A quick sidebar. I went to the Libertarian nominating convention 4 years ago in 2016 over Memorial Day. It was in Orlando, Florida. It was in a hotel convention center that was hosting the Libertarian Convention and a cartoon cosplay convention. So all of the cosplay people were mixing with the Libertarians. And honestly, sometimes there was some of the Libertarians came costumed as well. And then also off to the side, there was an Irish step dancing competition. So it was a real like mishmash of things, true to Libertarian form. I think Justin Amash.
That is like the perfect vignette of America.
It was honestly it was fun, but also really interesting. Like Libertarians are an interesting group. You know, there's a lot, we can have a whole conversation about Libertarians, but it was a fun weekend. Anyway, Justin Amash, I think this is relevant in the sense of, why is Justin Amash running if he's been so disillusioned by Trump? If he doesn't want Trump to be the president, shouldn't he, going back to our previous segment, from a real politique point of view, shouldn't he say, like other never-Trumpers, you know what, I'm going to vote for Biden. He's a traditional politician. I think he's got some, you know, more middle-of-the-road views. Great. This is extenuating circumstances. I'll vote for him. I do think the reason why Amash is running is the reason why previous third-party candidates have run before, which is it's a certain personality type that is more of that ideologue, right? His presence as a member of the Freedom Caucus tells you something about Justin Amash, right? Which is that he has a certain idealistic, maybe unrealistic if you're being less charitable to him, view of what is possible within the current system of American politics. Also, if we're giving him credit for being a politician and being a real politique practitioner, which I think he probably is on some level, what a great way to raise your profile, right? You know, is run for president. We've talked about this before.
Wait, also, from another realpolitik perspective, he might not have won re-election as an independent in his Republican congressional district.
Right. Yeah.
Anyway, so I think, you were saying.
So, you know, yeah, so it's a kind of like, why not move? And what I think what we'll get into here is he's a Michigander, and those ganders have a lot of ways to goose the 2020 election. Ayo.
Oh, come on.
Michigan. The people from Michigan.
I'm getting a look from across
the room. We've had surprisingly few presidents. I think Gerald Ford is the only Michigander who became president. And
I'm surprised you've had any.
Oh, I mean, Micah.
I mean, after North Dakota, is Michigan the worst state?
Romney was a kinda almost.
What's Pennsylvania brought us? Isn't like James Buchanan from Pennsylvania?
What?
Wait, Micah, are you from Jersey or Pennsylvania?
Same thing.
I'm from Pennsylvania. I went to high school in Jersey. But I would say, you know, based on the latest data I've seen, after North Dakota, Michigan probably the worst state.
Okay,
in the
I'm going to tell you something. The only president,
give or take Ohio, probably,
is James Buchanan. Maybe the worst president of all time. Okay? That's a terrible record. That's terrible.
Wait, you're running on Gerald Ford? Actually, I like Gerald Ford.
Just fine.
I think Nate wins this argument.
What? Michigan? Michigan, where they go to a lake and call it a beach?
This is getting off the rails fast.
Let's not get back into that.
Isn't Pennsylvania landlocked?
Yes, because New Jersey prevents it from really having beach.
That's true.
I guess you got like a little bit of the...
We consider the Jersey Shore as really just part of Pennsylvania.
Yeah, Erie, Pennsylvania has lake.
First of all, we have the Delaware River. We have a lake, and like I said, we consider the Jersey Shore basically part of Pennsylvania. Okay, Amash. So I think what Claire said, the fact that Biden won or is the presumptive Democratic nominee makes the Amash candidacy a bit weird. If Bernie had won, then you'd be like, okay, this makes a fair amount of sense, just ideologically, right? But you would think, at least on paper, Amash would be more okay with a Biden presidency than a Bernie presidency, certainly, and probably than a Trump presidency, given that he voted to impeach him. The other thing, just to lay out there, like a few things, if history holds, Amash will get very few votes. Most likely his support will kind of peter out as Election Day approaches. And I think it's tough to say who he'll pull more support from. You know, when he announced this, I think you saw a lot of Biden supporters say, hey, what the f***, man? Like, you're going to sort of split the anti-Trump vote. But you could equally say, okay, maybe he'll split the conservative vote, right? So I don't think it's obvious. Really, I think where Clara ended what she was saying is maybe the most meaningful part of this, which is Michigan, Amash's home state, likely to be a very close election, although who knows, given this coronavirus stuff. And so could he play spoiler? You know, a lot of people accused Jill Stein and Gary Johnson of playing spoiler in these states in 2016. But the margins are so close. And if they are, again, like anything could play spoiler. So I don't know. Nate, do you have an opinion about who he'll pull more from?
I mean, I think there's just this thing among Democrats in general in the era of Trump to assume that any possible piece of news must be bad for their candidate, right? To a first approximation, you probably won't get that many votes, I think, because people see the election as being hugely consequential. They're less likely to vote for a third party. And, you know, libertarianism is not a hugely popular set of beliefs in the U.S. And Amash, in some ways, is more of a pure kind of constitutionalist libertarian than like the Gary Johnson, oh, libertarian means that we're going to smoke more weed kind of libertarian, right? So, you know, it might be less popular, right? But look, I mean, as a very naive prior, he is a conservative, and Trump is the candidate of the more conservative party, right? You can start to see why that's not a great prior without too much examination, because Trump is a very different type of conservative in almost kind of quite opposite ways that Justin Amash is conservative. But to a first approximation, to have a third-party candidate on the right, I think is probably not great news for Trump. I don't know, right? The question is, like, who would the never-Trump Republicans have voted for in the end? Does he give them an off-ramp for voting for Trump, or an off-ramp for voting for Biden? And I'm not sure about that either way. And there isn't a lot of polling on him either. So
I will say, in terms of the Never Trumpers, I think, and Perry Bacon Jr., one of our senior writers, has a piece coming out on this, that you've seen a lot of Never Trumpers become more and more enmeshed in the Democratic Party. And so if you're a Never Trumper, you've been a member of the Republican Party probably your whole life, and then you see Trump as such a threat to the Democratic norm that you abandon the party, some people leave the party, a lot of people are supporting Biden, or at least trying to affect the Democratic primary, then I have a hard time believing a lot of those people will turn around and be like, oh, but I'm going to vote for someone who has no chance of winning. And then the other thing just to throw out there is, I find the libertarian part of this story super interesting. I think libertarianism is always like a fascinating story. Libertarian ideas, some of them at least, like smoking pot, are super popular. And a lot of times you'll see like libertarian groups send out press releases where they take like their most popular position and they're like, you know, actually 80% of people are libertarians. But and a lot of their ideas are really popular. The Libertarian Party, or being a capital L libertarian, is not popular at all. And so, you know, there's a version of this, I think, that could work either as a third party candidacy or as, you know, running as one of the major parties, but not the like hardcore across the board libertarian version.
Yeah. I mean, to that point, as we speak, Amash is polling at about 2% nationally. But when you do look at some of the very minimal polling that has been done, looking at who Amash would pull more support from, I'm looking at some reporting from David Beiler in the Washington Post. A 2019 Michigan poll showed that Biden's statewide margin dropped from 12 points to 6 points when Amash was included in that Michigan poll. And then nationally, a Democratic firm found that Amash was pulling more support from Democrats and Democratic-leaning independents than from Republicans and Republican-leaning independents, 7% to 4%. So maybe not all of that big anyway. that gets me to this question, which is, who is a Justin Amash voter? Like, who are these people that, you know, were thinking of voting for Biden, and then when Amash is now an option, that's who they go for? Is it just never Trump Republicans? What's the, like, if you had to describe an Amash voter, who is it?
Yeah, it's never Trump Republicans, right? That's pretty straightforward, I think. I think he's probably, like, probably a good candidate for them. But, you know, but, like, what do never Trump Republicans do in the end? I guess they, like, maybe they would vote for Biden. Maybe I'm talking myself into thinking that, like, that Amash running is not great news for Biden. But if you call them never Trump Republicans, it kind of, like, begs the question a little bit.
Right.
There's subsets of those, though, yeah. Right? Like, there's subsets of them that are, like, that are the true ideologues who would maybe consider Amash because they do have a problem with voting for a Democrat or someone who supports pro-choice positions, whatever it might be. And then there's this other set of people that are like, I'm never Trump for reasons of pure political expediency, which is I want to vote for the person who's going to win, who will kick Trump out of office. Therefore, I have to vote Joe Biden, even if I admire Justin Amash, whatever. And I think those are a more overwhelming proportion of never Trumpers, because that's kind of the approach that a lot of Americans, I think, now take to partisan politics.
It's in the name, really. My best guess is that Amash will draw from a portion of Gary Johnson's voters in 2016. And Gary Johnson didn't get a lot of votes. So if Amash is getting a portion of that vote, then you can't see him going very far. But again, a lot of these states maybe are going to be super close. So, you know, if Amash does end up drawing disproportionately from one candidate, and we don't know that he will, but if he does, then he could have a real effect on the race.
Was it you, Mike, or Claire, who mentioned abortion? That's an interesting subset of voter, right? Because you do hear some then like, boy, I really don't like Trump, but, you know, I'm a pro-life voter, and therefore I couldn't bring myself to vote for a pro-choice, pro-abortion, they might say, Democrat, right? That might be a narrow but non-trivial set of people that that are taken from Trump if you have a conservative third-party candidate.
Abortion, by the way, is a weird issue for libertarians, though, right? So if you're trying to win the nomination at the Libertarian Convention, you're probably going to make some concessions if you're a pro-life former Republican.
Yeah, and as we were talking about, those conventions are a little unconventional. And so,
yes.
So it's not, you know, who knows?
Can I throw one other thing in here, which is we had an article on the site about this from Jeff Skelly and Julia Azari. And one thing they were saying is that, you know, looking at history and kind of political science research on this, third-party candidacies tend to do better when the major parties are in a state of transition. So Ross Perot did really well when, you know, Democrats were debating whether to, you know, the kind of new, you know, like the, what's the Clinton group called? The
New Democrat.
New Democrat, right. And kind of tack to the center, you know, Republicans were deciding whether to kind of stick with like the George H.W. Bush old guard or the Pat Buchanan kind of cultural conservatism. And that partly explains, I think, why in 2016, while you had some conditions that would make you think, oh, a third party candidate, this is their year. You know, you have two major party nominees who are just historically disliked, as Claire mentioned earlier. And yet we didn't see a big third party vote. I think because the parties are sort of very, very, very defined. And they're very, very defined again in 2020. So,
to your point though, Michael, we did see in some of the districts, areas of the country that swung a lot from like Romney to Clinton or from Obama to Trump, there was actually larger numbers of kind of Johnson or left blank voting than you had seen in previous years. So the parts of the country that actually were in transition, you did see more of that rejecting both candidates kind of behavior, at least from the reporting that I did looking at polls down in, for example, like West Houston that went far from, you know, Romney to Clinton, for example.
Yeah. And those parts of the country, the like parts of the country where they have a lot of people that are in the more tenuous, you know, camps within each party, right? So in the Democratic Party, that's moderates, right? Kind of like culturally conservative moderates. And in the, or I shouldn't say the more tenuous camps, I should say the parts of the party that feel like the rest of the party is moving away from them. Because actually, moderates still have a ton of power within the Democratic Party, as is evidenced by Biden winning. But like culturally conservative moderates in the Democratic Party, and there's still a lot of them, or socially liberal moderates in the Republican Party, like suburban, more educated, socially liberal voters in the GOP. Yeah, those are the groups, I think, Galen, you're right, that you would expect to maybe be more open to a third party run. But even if you saw more of that in those places, you still didn't see much of it, right? So I don't know. But could Amash make some crazy run in 2020? Sure. I think we've all been shown anything can happen, but it would be very, very surprising based on the historical precedent.
All right, let's leave it there. Thank you, Nate.
Thank you, Galen.
Thanks, Claire.
Thanks, Galen.
And thank you, Micah.
Thank you.
And before we go, I wanted to bring in our colleague, Anna Rothschild, who's hosting 538's new podcast about the coronavirus pandemic. It's called Podcast 19. So here with me is Anna. Hey, Anna, how's it going?
Good. How are you, Galen?
You know, doing well. So Podcast 19, I love the name. Tell us a little bit about what you're going to be uncovering there, what kinds of things you're exploring.
Sure. So this is a podcast that's going to be really focused on what we know and what we really don't know about the coronavirus. This is a completely new disease, so no one has ever really had time to study it except for the past few months. So there's a lot that even the experts are kind of just guessing about at this point, which is why I think the news can feel just so confusing these days. So what we really want to do is both explain the science, explain the breakthroughs as we fight this disease, but also put them into context and explain what the uncertainties still are about these breakthroughs.
I love that. I feel like that's what we're always trying to do at 538. So give us a little taste about some of the stories that you've been working on.
Sure. So in our first episode, which you can download now, we looked at those antibody tests, the serology tests that really there's been a lot of conflict about in the news. You know, there were the reports out of Santa Clara that maybe the number of people who've actually encountered COVID-19 was maybe 85 times higher than the official counts. So we really wanted to dig into these tests and figure out just how accurate are these things? Should you be running out and getting one? And really, like, is there much benefit to it? Or is the benefit really more for public health in general? In upcoming episodes, we're going to look at just how long it's really going to take to make a vaccine for this virus and how you even go about doing that. We're going to answer some of the sort of mysteries about coronavirus, like why more men seem to be dying from the virus than women, why certain people get really, really sick and other people, it's just sort of like a, you know, a bad cold. And we're actually also going to be taking questions from the audience. So if anyone out there has a question about coronavirus, please drop us a voice memo at askpodcast19@gmail.com.
Awesome. And just to repeat, the name of the podcast is Podcast 19. So that's podcast-19. We've got some great art, animated coronavirus. What is it, a cell? I don't even know. I have to listen to the podcast.
Well, you know, I think that's sort of a debatable thing. Viruses aren't actually living things, so it's not a cell in the same way that, you know, your body is made of cells. But maybe that's something we can talk about on the podcast one day.
All right, that's my first question for the podcast. What do we call those things with the coronas on them that we've seen?
Viruses, viral particles.
Viral particles, okay. All right, anyway, well, definitely go subscribe, rate, and review, and get yourself straightened out on coronavirus news over at Podcast 19. But anyway, thank you so much for joining me on here, Anna.
Thank you so much, Galen.
All right. My name is Galen Druk. Tony Chow is in the virtual control room. You can get in touch by emailing us at podcasts@538.com. You can also, of course, tweet at us with questions or comments. If you're a fan of the show, leave us a rating or a review in the Apple Podcast Store or tell someone about us. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you soon.